edition of With All Due Respect. Strong opinions on politics, life, and entertainment.
Welcome to another episode of With All Due Respect, the podcast that can take a nothing day and suddenly make it all seem worthwhile, or at least make it tolerable. We have very realistic expectations on this podcast. Greetings, I'm Andrew Hauker, your host for this slow descent into madness. With me, as always, is my main man, my go-to with the no-to, Mr. Van Sanders. Mr. Sanders, what is the good word for the day?
The good word is sunlight, I think. And I know I've said that before, but man, it is really coming out, and I'm feeling good, ready for some awesome springtime walks.
Excellent. Today on With All Due Respect, a full menu for you to choose from. In local politics, last week, Anchorage voters sent a clear message to Mayor Dave Bronson, like a Luca Brasi kind of clear message. In state politics, it's budget time, which means it's amendment time, which means it's hypocrisy time. See how that works? We'll discuss. In federal politics, while U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, the great Lisa Murkowski, was busy this week putting an exclamation point on bipartisanship, her opponent Kelly Schiavacca was busy telling supporters she'd outlaw birth control sent through the mail. Wowzy. In our live segment, Russia has returned to the 1930s Stalin purge era, where rights and freedoms are being curtailed and where any public dissent is being met with prison. Meanwhile, here in America, some state governments have begun to do the exact same thing. Yep, you guessed it. A funny thing happened on the way to democracy. And finally, this episode we premiere a new segment called Campaign Notebook.
Campaign Notebook.
In our initial Campaign Notebook segment today, we will take a look at Sarah Palin's entrance into the race for Congress and lay out her road ahead. There's our ride, so hop in. Let's talk some politics.
Politics. And now, for some politics.
In local politics, last week's Anchorage municipal elections told a story that many have been waiting a year to hear. The kids are all right. In order to put this into context, we need a history lesson. Mr. Sanders, I pray upon you, my good sir, please bless us with a history lesson.
A history lesson.
Almost 1 year ago, the voters of Anchorage, who were angry and tired of pandemic government, were being serenaded with the promises of a better way. A better way to deal with the homeless. A better way to make government more transparent. A better way to return trust to local government. A better way with Dave. So last May, by a margin of 1,200 votes out of 90,000 votes cast, the slimmest margin in Anchorage mayoral history, Dave Bronson was elected the mayor of our fine city. The days of a better way with Dave were upon us. So with a razor-thin victory and a completely divided electorate, one would think the mayor would govern from the middle. Not even close. For the last year, Bronson has wielded a heavy hand as he's lurched the entire municipal apparatus into the right-hand ditch. He instantly became authoritarian, many times without regard to ethics, the law, or basic moral decency. He attacked physicians in hospitals. Anchorage suffered record COVID deaths on his watch. His administration was caught not once, but twice lying to the press and the public just 8 months into their term. So, after almost a year of unmitigated cronyism, management chaos, and illegal behavior, the voters of Anchorage have spoken. Mayor Dave Bronson's better way ain't better, and it ain't the way. In a stunning rebuke of historic proportions, voters across Anchorage last week sent a clear message to Bronson that they disagree with his management of Anchorage. After deploying what could only be called the single biggest coordinated attempt to unseat incumbents in local political history, the mayor's effort failed miserably. Bronson-allied candidates suffered humiliating defeats in 5 of their 6 races, losing by an average of 8 points. So, when you add last Thursday's election results to the previous 2 failed recall attempts of assembly members, that means Mayor Bronson and his allies have lost 7 of 8 elections since he has become mayor. But what makes these results so incredibly stunning is that this mayor left nothing on the table for any of those efforts. Traditionally, local mayors are reticent about wading into battle against assembly incumbents simply to the fact that if your challenger fails, you're left to deal with the fallout. But not Bronson. Oh, no, no, no. This guy unloaded all of his ammunition and then he stopped to reload. He put in heavy effort with recruitment of candidates, funding of candidates, coordination of candidates. He donated to them. He rallied for them. He waved signs for them on street corners. Bronson even allowed volunteers to make campaign calls using a phone number attached to his name so the caller ID would appear as if you were getting a call from the mayor himself. Personally, I have never witnessed the degree of coordination and funding orchestrated against incumbents by any previous mayor. So, after the last 8 months of pulling every trick to defeat incumbents short of personally stuffing ballot boxes, Van, would you please tell the mayor what he's won?
Congratulations, Mayor Bronson. You've won a new car. No, not at all. You've won the right to pay the band now that you're done dancing. You've won a more empowered assembly. You've won the right to face subpoenas. That's right, subpoenas. For refusing to answer questions about cronyism, ethics violations, conflicts of interest, and illegal use of government funds. And to top off that impressive gift package, we're throwing in another downtown assembly seat in June, which will be one more vote on the assembly to hold you accountable. Congratulations, Mr. Mayor.
If last week's Anchorage municipal elections proved anything, it's that Anchorage is back to normal. The kids are all right. Anchorage is all right. And to quote the great Frank Costanza, we're back, baby. In state politics, this past week, the Alaska House of Representatives voted on the fiscal year 2023 operating budget, and I feel 2 key amendments are really worth commenting on. First, you'll remember last fall the court found Governor Dunleavy and his henchman Tuckerman Babcock had violated state employees' constitutional rights after they made the employees sign a loyalty pledge when Dunleavy came into office. You'll also might remember the judge ruled that Dunleavy and Babcock could be held personally liable because it was an act of personal politics. And then you might remember that just before the ink was dry on the court's ruling, Dunleavy passed the bill onto taxpayers. You remember that, right? Well, 2 conservative lawmakers jumped across the aisle last week to approve an amendment that stripped the funding for Dunleavy's lawsuit settlement out of the state budget, thus heretofore denying the governor his taxpayer-funded get-out-of-jail-free card, which sets up a total showdown. However, knowing Governor Mike Dunleavy's conservative use of ethics and his liberal use of government money for political purposes, I'm sure he'll find another door to try and slip the bill under. But the main draw of the annual budget stage production is getting to hear a collection of old white guys opine on women's reproductive rights. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, that gets us to everyone's least favorite political topic, abortion rights. Now, a couple of facts before we begin. First, Alaska is one of the most pro-choice states in America. Let me repeat that. According to the Pew Research, 63% of Alaskans support a woman's right to choose, which means Alaska is even more pro-choice than California. 2. In 1972, Alaskans adopted a constitutional amendment guaranteeing the right to privacy, and as such, a woman's right to choose has been protected as a constitutional right by the courts for over 4 decades. But, you know, law schmaws, who cares about the law or the Constitution, right? So as always, conservative lawmakers continue their annual attacks on Alaska's women, ignoring the Constitution, ignoring the law, all while attempting to give government more power over personal rights. And not just any personal rights, no, women's reproductive rights. Yes, exactly. the same thing lawmakers, male lawmakers, know absolutely, positively nothing about. But yet here they are, gonna make some public policies about a woman's body. Last week, a parade of mostly old white guys rose on the House floor to argue that government should have more control over women's bodies than the women themselves. I mean, think about that. In what world, with the exception of The Handmaid's Tale, would that make sense? Seriously, if these lawmakers had their way, a woman in Alaska would have less rights than a handgun does. Now, even though it is virtually impossible, let's put the loss of one's ability to control their own destiny aside. Okay, so where are we? We're going to have government take away women's reproductive rights and give them to government. Aside from how dystopian that sounds, that never deters religious conservatives. Representative Sarah Vance, a Republican from Homer, argued that she didn't care about the Constitution because every child's life is precious. Okay, this is a really good time to explain that this debate isn't about children. It's never about children. It's about enforcing a religious ideology. Because if it were about children, then lawmakers like Representative Vance would actually care about children. I mean, let's ask ourselves, what are lawmakers like Representative Vance doing to support the life of a child, especially considering that 45% of pregnancies are unplanned and today 1 in 6 children are growing up in a single-parent household? This is why the annual budgeting debate is so insightful, because it gives anti-choice lawmakers like Representative Vance the opportunity to truly put their money where their mouth is from a public policy side to support their ideology. Unfortunately, this is also where the hypocrisy of the religious right rears its ugly, ugly head. The same lawmakers who claim they loved children so much they're willing to ignore the Constitution and take away a woman's reproductive rights did nothing to invest in Alaska's children. They voted to cut pre-K education. They voted to cut K-12 education. They voted to cut health care and child care. So how do you claim to love children, but yet do nothing to actually show you care for them as a public policymaker? Because they don't actually care about children once they're born. As a former legislator, I spent 4 years listening to pro-life religious conservatives like John Coghill and Fred Dyson argue behind closed caucus doors that birth control was a recreational drug while at the same time saying Denali Kid Care was socialism. Never once during that entire time did I hear either of them advocating for anything to improve the lives of children once they were born. Never once to increase education investments, to increase child services investments, to increase child health care investments. Never once. Never once in my entire political career have I witnessed a pro-life politician lead with policies that support children instead of leading with policies that simply take away a woman's rights. Now today, a new generation of conservatives wants to keep Alaskan women barefoot and pregnant. A new generation, but the same style of old white people who grew up on a steady diet of father knows best and believe government should control the rights of women. But let's just remember, Alaska is a state that embraces privacy so much, we became one of the only states in America whose residents adopted a constitutional right to privacy. And today, both the Alaska Supreme Court and 63% of Alaskans believe in a woman's right to make private health care decisions with her doctor. Alaska is one of the most pro-choice states in America and even more pro-choice than California. That, ladies and gentlemen, is critical to remember as we watch policymakers try and take away constitutional rights from Alaska's women. In federal politics, this past week, Alaska's only working U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski had a banner week. First, Murkowski crossed the aisle to support the appointment of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the United States Supreme Court. That was a historic bipartisan vote. But that wasn't enough history-making for Murkowski. 2 days later, she was in Anchorage at the Arctic Symposium with Democratic Senator Joe Manchin sharing the stage and talking about the shared energy goals they had and the need for bipartisanship. Somebody's got to start the conversation and you bring people into it, Murkowski told the audience. If you just kind of sit back and say somebody else is going to do it, nobody's going to do it, and bipartisanship wouldn't exist. The next day, Murkowski addressed the packed crowd of 1,000 Alaskans as she explained the billions in historic infrastructure investments she negotiated with the White House. Ladies and gentlemen, this past week was yet another example of why Alaska needs Lisa Murkowski now more than ever in the United States Senate. Meanwhile, where was Murkowski's opponent Kelly Schiavacca, you ask? Well, she was busy being recorded telling a small group of supporters that as Alaska's U.S. Senator, she would make it a federal crime to send birth control through the mail. So to recap, U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski spent her week delivering justice for America, along with roads, broadband, and ferries for Alaska, all while advocating for more moderation in politics. While her opponent, Kelly Schiavacca, spent her week criticizing Lisa Murkowski while promising to make it a felony for Alaskans to receive birth control through the mail. Good thing we have a choice this election.
And now, let's talk about life.
In our life segment today, the U.S. and Russia. Same song, just a different verse. Since Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, Russians have witnessed a return of Stalin-era tactics in their country. Just like 75 years ago, citizens have become informers. On Sakhalin Island, an 8th grade teacher was reported, then fined and fired after telling her students she believed the Ukraine was an independent country. In Moscow, a computer repair technician was given a $1,200 fine for a sign he posted in the shop window that read, "No War." Across Russia, friends and family are being pitted against one another by government. Since the beginning of the invasion of Ukraine, crackdown on dissent, there have been over 400 prosecutions under the new law that bans criticism of Russia's military. Think about that. It is a complete and total effort by government to silence dissent. So where does that sound like? Well, in Texas, they recently passed legislation restricting women's health care choices and then incentivized neighbors to not only report them, but sue them. In Florida, they recently passed legislation to restrict what could be presented to LGBTQ students, where violators will face prosecution. All over America, states are passing laws that have chilling effects on personal freedoms and free speech. Here in Anchorage, several school board candidates, backed by Mayor Bronson recently, advocated removing books from public schools and restricting subject matters. So how is the legislation in these states any different from Putin's Russia? How is it that the same people who have spent the last 2 years complaining about government robbing them of their personal rights are now using government to rob women and minority groups of their personal rights? Once again, how different is the current trend of restricting freedoms and punishing speech in Russia any different than the current trend of restricting and punishing free speech in America? There is absolutely no difference. Look, ladies and gentlemen, we can wrap ourselves up in an American flag all day long, but what's happening in St. Petersburg, Russia, with regards to the restriction of personal rights and freedoms is no different than what's happening in St. Petersburg, Florida. In a new segment called Campaign Notebook, we will offer a glimpse into Alaska's congressional race over the next few months viewed through the lens of a candidate. Today we kick off looking at Sarah Palin's entrance into the race and what that could mean to the existing field.
Campaign Notebook.
Last week, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin decided to tap into the race for Alaska's lone congressional seat. Now, as you may know, I have history with Sarah Palin. Yes, we were a thing back in 2006, but this ain't 2006, and this ain't that Sarah Palin. Palin enters the race at the exact opposite end of the political spectrum where she entered 16 years ago. When Palin announced her run for governor 16 years ago, she caught the attention of a wide swath of Alaskans seeking a palate cleanser after the term of Governor Frank Murkowski. Under Murkowski, you had 4 years of broken promises, along with the Vico scandal, the Greg Rehnquist ethics scandal, the Randy Riedrich ethics scandal, and of course, the infamous private jet. I love Frank, but God, he was so exhausting. So when Palin entered the gubernatorial race, Governor Murkowski already at that time had the lowest approval ratings of any governor in the United States. Palin went on to capitalize on Alaskans' anger towards the political establishment, but she also had a story to tell. She was a former mayor of Wasilla. She was a former Alaska Oil and Gas Commissioner who resigned under controversy. She took a hard line on Murkowski's relationship with Big Oil. She took a hard line on Murkowski's administration's broken promises and ethical lapses. By Labor Day weekend 2006, Palin was leading by 17 points in the polls, and it was pretty clear she was going to ride the wave all to Juneau. Palin had just enough of a plausible resume combined with her populist appeal at the exact right time proved her ability to win in a three-way election. However, during the 10 months I spent on the campaign trail with Sarah Palin, her ability to get elected was in direct proportion to her ability to produce glittering generalities. She skated through that entire campaign without having to compete on one public policy idea. She rarely articulated any public policies because she never had to. 16 years later, it appears that the only thing that's changed is she knows even less about public policy, which seems impossible, but it's true. And if you're looking for any clues as to what role Palin will play in the race, just look at her initial campaign announcement. Sarah Palin's announcement entering the race for Congress was like a Molotov cocktail being thrown through the front window of Alaskans, proclaiming the sacrifice of public service had beckoned her because she was worried about Alaska being hijacked by, quote, namby-wamby pussy wussies. Now, for the record, it's hard for your host to imagine Palin being worried about Alaskans, or Alaska for that matter, while spending her days and nights traversing New York's Upper East Side, but benefit of the doubt and all. Palin enters the race competing for votes on the center-right to the far-right of the political spectrum. Her only competitor for that particular audience at this time appears to be Nick Begich. Now, since she's been absent the last 13 years, thus has not accomplished much other than appearing on Dancing with the Stars, what does Palin run on? Let's be honest, here is a candidate that will raise a significant amount of money, but yet has no positive accomplishments to run on. So what's the pitch? What's her message to voters? I'll tell you what her message is going to be. It's going to be the world is on fire and my opponent is holding the match. Since Sarah Palin has no positive accomplishments to run on and certainly doesn't want to remind voters that Governor Palin quit the last time voters hired her, she will have no alternative other than to spend her resources attacking her opponents, attempting to draw attention away from herself and cast blame on them. The challenge for Palin is that she's already known. She already has a base, but her base has been eaten away, so that means Palin has to steal votes back from somewhere. And since she can't steal votes on her accomplishments, she'll try and steal votes by selling voters on how bad the other Republicans are. Her campaign message will be a continuous loop of attack ads about fraudulent elections, fake Republicans, and of course, the famous lamestream media. Now, Palin's entrance into the race has created fascinating dynamics for the Republican far right. There is no doubt that the biggest loser in Palin's entrance is Nick Begich. And personally, your host believes this food fight on the far right is going to be delicious. For the last year, Nick Begich has been courting the far right, picking up key endorsements from conservative lawmakers even before the untimely death of Don Young. Begich had gone to great lengths to portray himself as someone who was more conservative than Young, even blasting Young for his vote supporting the recent infrastructure bill. Begich's campaign strategy was to beat Young by trying to pass him on the right by owning the farthest right lane in portraying Young as old and not conservative enough. In doing so, Begich staked his turf early, and the dude is literally stuck in the farthest right lane. Unfortunately for young Mr. Begich, the farthest right lane is also Sarah Palin's only lane to victory. And since one lane cannot be occupied by two vehicles, Nick Begich is about to have his rearview mirror filled up with the sight of Sarah Palin's monster truck bearing down on him. Again, Palin is going to raise a lot of money from outside people who adore her, but yet don't have to be governed by her. So look for Sarah Palin to spend most of her resources going after the two regions of Alaska that will provide her only path to victory, the Mat-Su and Kenai. Interestingly enough, the Mat-Su and Kenai are also the very same two regions that will provide Nick Begich his only path to victory as well. Sarah Palin's role in this campaign will be simple. With the lack of anything positive to campaign on and Nick Begich occupying the farthest right lane, Palin's only way forward is to chase Begich down and steal his voters. And ladies and gentlemen, we get to watch it unfold in real time.
Politics.
In closing comments, my race to fill the remaining portion of former Representative Don Young's term is underway. We've launched our website at whyhowcrow.com. That's whyhowcrow.com. Our campaign media will launch soon. But in the meantime, you can read about our campaign. You can send me an email. You can donate, which would be very appreciated. One thing I would suggest if you do go to our website, the last link on the page is a presentation I made about the public safety problems at the former downtown transit center in 2015. Looking back, I still cannot believe how wild and lawless the downtown transit center was. Van, dare I ask your thoughts on our time spent together in the transit center?
Sure. I think I would just call it eye-opening. There's no judgment to be passed. It was more just that there was a lot of unfortunate and sad things happening that just didn't need to happen. And it wasn't any fault of any individual. It was just kind of a nexus of poor design in the building itself and just, you know, kind of neglect. It had been ignored for the longest time and just allowed to be what it was. And then, you know, predators found their way there and took advantage of people. And it just wasn't a good situation. And it's good that it's closed now.
Yes, good times. Good times. So again, ladies and gentlemen, please visit our campaign website at whyhowcrow.com. And there is the music, ladies and gentlemen, and you know what that means. Our time is up. Please subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss an episode. Van, how about your website information?
If you'd like to visit my website, that's abodabobrand.com, abodabobrand.com. You can reach out to me and see some examples of previous work. You should also check out whyhalcrow.com. That's whyhalcrow.com. I've got a link to my page at the bottom of Andrew's.
And there is our time, ladies and gentlemen, and we thank you for yours.